Well, let me start by asking you to give your name for purposes of the record, and then we'll get into the recording we're going to do this afternoon, this narration you're going to provide us with.
Well, my proper name is Lorraine Marrier, commonly now called Larry.
And as Larry, I've known you for something over 30 years, I think, having come to St. Paul's late in the fall of 1978, so...
Well, I went through high school using the name Lorraine with no problems. Of course, back in the early 30s, Lorraine was as commonly used for boys as it was for girls. And it wasn't until I was promoted to the officer ranks in the Army that a certain captain came along about the second day in the officer's mess and said, "I hear your name is Lorraine." "That's right, sir. From now on, it's Larry, and don't you forget it." So,
it's been Larry.
So it was Larry. And now I get both names.
Yes.
Depending on who.
Sure. How long people have known you and so on. Well, you haven't yourself worked in the grain trade, I don't believe, which is, of course, the purpose of these Voices of the Grain Trade interviews.
No.
But you have told me that your father had a very intimate connection with it, and so you've agreed to tell us about your father's career since he passed on, you said earlier, 1975, was it?
Yes.
So it's 35 years he's been gone, and a little bit more. Anyway, why don't you give us his name, say something about his earlier life, and then how he became involved in the grain trade, and we can begin exploring that.
His name was Ambrose Peter Marguier, if you want.
Of course.
He was born in Saint-Agathe, Quebec, about 1987, I think.
1887?
Yeah, 1887, yeah. He left home when he was approximately 20 years old.
1907.
He worked for 2 winters in the area of Spanish Ontario.
North shore of Lake Huron.
Yeah. In the lumbering industry. And at the end of the second winter, he heard that there was lots of work around Port Arthur and Fort William, because they were constructing grain elevators up here. And so he came up. He had no English at that point, unless he learned some in the bush, which I doubt. Mm-hmm. And he got a job on the construction of an elevator over on the Cam River, running a donkey engine to unload piling off flat cars or off wagons that would be hauled in by team. And during the course of that job, he got to know a chap by the name of Mackenzie from Stanley. Mackenzie had a sawmill in Stanley, and he was also had some timber limits up there and was supplying piling for the that particular elevator.
Mm-hmm.
When the job got close to being completed, he said to my father one day, "You were brought up on a farm, weren't you?" "Yes." "You know how to drive a team of horses?" "Yes." "I've got a job for you, driving the team." So Dad took that job and moved to Stanley. Now, the important part of the job was to pick up rich Americans at the Murillo CPR station and drive them out to the silver mines up towards Hymers, the Beaver Mine, the Animiki, Silver Mountain.
And they were working at the time, were they?
Well, those mines were working, yeah. And these were the guys that owned the mines.
Yes.
And he would drive them up, and they'd arrange for him to pick them up and take them back. And, of course, in those days, two cars or three cars through Stanley, and you had a traffic jam.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly horse and buggy or horse and cutter in the winter. And that's where he met my mother. Her father worked for the CNR. He was a section foreman, ostensibly on the PD railway, but in those days the main line from Port Arthur went through Stanley and up along the Cam River.
The Canadian Northern people had taken over the Port Arthur, Duluth, and Western Railway, the PD, as you said, and made it part of the Transcontinental Line as it was becoming.
Well, the Transcontinental Line branched off at Stanley from the PD. Mm-hmm. The PD continued on up to North Lake.
Oh, yes, whereas this other line ran onto Fort Francis and onto the prairies.
No.
Or is it the other way that we're tracing it?
No, the line going to Fort Francis branched off at Superior Junction, which was on the far on the west side of Kekabeka.
Okay.
Yeah. The PD was supposed to connect with a railway coming up from Duluth.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that railway got as far as Grand Marais and stopped.
The original intention.
Yeah. And but the PD continued to operate until about 1934.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly which year, but about then, when the big wood supply up through that area ran out.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't born here, you won't remember, but starting where the old fort is now and following the ridge, the high stuff, from there up beyond Whitefish was white pine, like that. Great, huge white pine.
And that was all cut out during those...
Cut right out. And not replanted.
20 years or so.
Yeah. Not replanted.
Well, of course, there was regeneration. The white pine was supposed to happen naturally, the lands and forest people were told. Anyway, pressing on towards the grain trade.
Anyways, he worked for Mackenzie, I don't know quite how many years. He and my mother were married in 1919, and I think the wedding was the 30th of June.
Oh, yes, and so you were the eldest then, I take it.
Yeah, I'll go into that. But at the in the spring of that year, he was hired by the Lakes, the Thunder Bay Grain Trimmers Association.
Okay.
That was quite an organization. It was both an association and a union, the same group.
Yeah. Now, this was quite a jump for him to from working. Well, of course, he was driving and so on. Had he been doing that work through the teens, through the war years, or had he been working in the city?
No, he had been doing that job. He couldn't get in the Army because at some point during his teen years, they found it necessary to take the bone out of his right thumb. So he just had a little stub with a thumbnail on it.
Good. I suppose he was right-handed to boot. So.
Yeah, and they said he couldn't do the rifle drill.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Take him.
They have been spared death in the trenches as a result.
Yeah. Now, they continued to live in Stanley, and he rented a house on Macquarie Avenue in Port Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
He was the boss trimmer at Pool 1, Manitoba Pool 1 elevator.
And which one was that?
That's the second one from the far end at Intercity. The one closest to the Kiefer Terminal is the... I had the name.
P&H.
Parish and Heimbecker. And Pool 1 is the next one this way.
Okay, so that was in operation circa 1920 already, and that's where...
And it's been enlarged quite a bit since then. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what... how come he got the job?
I don't know. I don't know. He probably had rubbed up against somebody in the work he was doing.
And, yes. It's so a career with the grain trimmers began.
And the great grain trimmers were the highest paid laborers in Canada by far because they signed their own contracts with the grain company, with the boat companies for loading.
Could you tell us something of what a grain trimmer did?
They loaded the grain on ships. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like a great deal, that it would take a great deal of skill, but it did. It took quite a bit of skill. They had two tools, a wooden shovel and a plow. But it wasn't the kind of a plow that you would have in a field. It was a piece of sheet metal about, I would say, maybe 30 inches wide and maybe 3 to 4 feet long, turned up at the side and fastened to a piece of 1x3 lumber, which projected out at one end in the form of two handles. And just, it was open. And when a ship's hold was about 3/4 full, or maybe a little more, one of them would take a plow and jump into the hold. And the plow would go under the stream of grain coming down the spouts, and they would fill in under the decks.
So he would
would plug it in tight.
He would be directing the flow of the grain using this plow.
Yeah. Now, I saw all this happen because in my young teen years, during summer holidays, I'd go down to Pool One with Dad for an afternoon.
Sure. Now, did you get to do any of the work, or were you mostly just watching?
No, I was just watching. I was too skinny to do that kind of work.
The grain would come down the spout with quite a force and speed.
Oh, yes,
and so this plow device would really...
They put the plow under that stream, and they could shoot the grain 15, 20 feet.
Sure.
And they could plug it up under the decks.
How large was a hold as a rule? Any kind of standard size?
Oh, I couldn't give you. You could probably.
Living room size?
Oh, no, it was more than that.
Yeah. 20 by 30 feet or something. Would they be square as a rule?
No, they weren't. They were built more like this table.
Yes.
But.
In any case,
they'd be 25 feet wide and maybe 35, 40 feet across.
And the force, if they were able to redirect the grain from the center,
the spout.
Yeah, the spout. I was just thinking, what would the hole be called?
The
hole would be in the center, and so I suppose the center of the hold is a rule.
Yeah.
What would you call the hold in the trap door and so on and so forth. In any case, the arrangement
it
would be open. But.
The holds had an opening almost the full width of the ship and 12, 15 feet wide.
I see.
And they'd take the covering right off.
Right. Oh, so it wasn't a small
trap door. And the spout was movable.
Sure.
Up and down or...
Right.
Back and forth.
Now, would a grain trimmer be involved in the movement of the spout on the deck as well?
Yes.
So there are two of them at least would be working together.
But they also had one guy down on the dock working a cable reel to raise or lower the spout.
Mm-hmm.
And...
So it would take three men per spout then?
Four or five.
Right, I see.
Because when you got to a certain place, it took maybe a couple of guys to pull on the rope to get that spout extended far enough.
Sure.
And the ships weren't all the same size.
No, of course. Well, that's one of the things I've been asking for, sort of standards.
I've never been down there. Well, I have once or twice, but I don't remember too well. With the big new liners. Mm-hmm. That freighters we have, because back in the early 30s, 100,000 bushel ship of wheat was a big ship.
This would be one of the big Lakers.
That would be a big Laker. Yeah. Well, the Meissners and the big CSL ships now are over 700 feet.
Yes, the ones that were built after the St. Lawrence
Seaway. So instead of 100,000 bushels, they hold 1 million bushels.
Yeah.
But... each hold had to be filled separately.
That was the real skill, to fill the holes both to make them as full as possible, but to keep the ship balanced, I guess.
Not only that, but if it got out in the storm on the lake, that cargo could not shift. It had to be plugged tight.
Right.
Yeah. And these guys knew what they were doing. Yeah. They were very good at it.
Yeah. So that's what your father began doing with others then. He began, I suppose, simply as one of the guys in the
yes.
crew.
Yeah. I don't know when he became boss trimmer at Pool One.
But he did rise to that position there.
And there was nothing more than he gave the orders at Pool One. And if he was working over at McCabe, somebody else was telling him what to do.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
I remember the super at Pool One at the time, a fellow by the name of Johnny Belanger. He'd come on board and he'd walk around on the deck on his hands. He was an athlete in the first water.
And this was the manager of a pool superintendent.
Yeah. But with a name like Belanger and my father's name, they got along very well.
Was Belanger from Quebec as well?
I don't know. No. I don't know.
Spoke French, though, I presume.
Well, he didn't sound French. But,
Of course, the Franco.
Of course, my father didn't sound particularly French by the time I really got to know him, except he said duh instead of the.
But he'd become well anglicized. Ontario did that to the Franco-Ontarians.
Well, my mother didn't know any French. She was Swedish descent.
Oh, yes.
I don't know whether it's not relevant, but he was raised a Roman Catholic. She was raised a Swedish Lutheran. They got married in St. Luke's Anglican Church. I was baptized in St. Luke's Anglican Church. And when they moved to Thunder Bay, to Port Arthur, when I was 7 years old, on the second Sunday of the September of the year they moved, they went to St. Paul's United Church.
Just barely United Presbyterian until 2 years before.
But why? And they stuck.
Yeah. Well, I think some number of people who didn't have Methodist or Presbyterian heritage found St. Paul's a welcoming place.
Yeah, well, the thing that, and I never thought to ask questions.
No.
The thing that puzzles me now is they walked right past St. Anthony's Catholic Church to get there.
Yeah.
They rented a house on Crown Street.
Oh, yes.
111 Crown.
Right, so they did walk past St. Anthony's.
Yeah, and the Swedish church was just a block down the hill to on Secord.
Yeah. Well,
then it was built right beside them.
Well, that's right, behind St. Paul's, in effect, up there on the corner. Although that was a little church, of course, it took a long time for them to get out of the basement and so on at that church.
Yeah.
Well, it may have been the sheer size of it. He thought he could fit in. Were there other trimmers going there by any chance? Because that
could be. The Chisholmores probably went there.
Chisholmores were.
Was a couple of Chisholmores who were there.
Okay.
And I talked to a fellow yesterday morning or Sunday morning at St. Paul's handing out bulletins. His name was McKinnon.
McKinnon?
Yeah, his father was a grain trimmer, too.
Yeah, we've interviewed Tom.
Oh, have you? Okay.
Now, Ken Graham was a trimmer. Was he a trimmer, too? Helen Graham's husband. His name was Ken, wasn't it? On River Street?
I don't recall that name.
No.
I
had the sense that he was, but I need to check back sometime to check why my memory says that. I guess go back in old Henderson's directory and see what it says for Graham. Well, the likeliest is that someone from the trimmers who went to St. Paul said, well, you know, why don't you come to our church? Because that would answer the question. And it could have been Tom's father. The McKinnon connection strikes me as fine, fine people, and so I can understand.
I have no idea. It would probably be, his connection would probably be to someone who had gotten him into the trimmers.
Yes. Yeah.
George Squire might have been the touch.
Mm-hmm.
He was a member of one up on Red River Road.
Trinity or?
No,
you mean
the Anglican.
St. Michael?
St. Michael's, yeah.
But he may have got him into the Great Trimmers.
He may have got him into the Trimmers.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I wonder if the records of the Trimmers exist from those early days. It's another question.
Well, let's go on.
Yes, by all means, press on.
We moved. My brother, I had a younger brother, two mm-hmm. years younger. He died in February of 1927. And we moved to town in August of 27. There was only one doctor in the two cities that would go out on calls out to that, and that was old Doc Caldwell. He lived on Hill Street. If you turn left on Hill, off going up Red River Road, there's a brick house on the left. That's where Dr. Caldwell lived.
Oh, yeah.
And he would come out in the winter with a horse and buggy, and in the summer with a horse and carriage.
Wow.
So he came out and visited sometime in late January or very early February. I'm 7 years
yeah,
old.
You were a little
guy. Just 6 years old at that point. And I think my brother had got pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
I brought a bug home from school and turned into pneumonia. And he was, it was a three-bedroom house. And my bedroom was here. My parents' bedroom was in that corner upstairs, and this was a spare room. And I can remember waking up about 3 o'clock in the morning. I just have the, and Arnold was sleeping in their room, was in their room. The light was on, not an electric light.
No.
Kerosene lamp.
Yeah.
And they had been keeping the window open because the doctor said he needed extra oxygen. And I could hear the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the south bank of the river, and there was a hill behind the house.
This is still all out of Stanley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the wolves were howling that night, and I could hear them.
And the air was pretty fresh, I do.
Oh, yeah. So he died.
Yeah.
That night he died. And I think that they decided then that come summer they were going to move into town.
Sure, closer to services.
Yeah.
Of all sorts.
In March, on a night when there was a tremendous snowfall, it was almost a blizzard. 9 o'clock at night, there was a knock and came to the front door. And of course, I'm all ears and anything unusual. And it was Doc Cole. Some woman out in South Gillies had phoned. She was going into labor, and it was going to be a difficult one. And he decided he'd have to go out. And he hired a cutter and horse. And he asked if he could come in and get warm. And my mother made him a coffee, a hot coffee.
Yeah.
Went on. The next afternoon, there's another knock at the door, and it's called. The first one, fine, it's a good boy.
Well, those are the joys of a doctor's life, I'm sure. But
yeah. So we moved into town.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in sometime in late 33 or early 1934, the Trimmers became aware that the guy that was running them, the fellow by the name of Moran, had been dipping into the till quite a bit. He'd been playing the stock market, and of course that was the wrong thing to do in the dirty 30s.
Yeah, the 4 years
and
after Black.
He'd lost a fair bit of money, and they fired him, or he quit, I'm not sure which. He committed suicide about 6 weeks later. And they appointed my father to take his place. And he finished. And he cheated a little bit, too. He was supposed to retire when he reached 70, but he worked till he was 72.
Well, that's a kind of cheating that's tolerable if the man is good. So 87, you were saying, 72 would make it, we have a 9. Now, let me see, am I getting the numbers right here? 23 off...
72, and he died at 88, so 16.
Yeah.
Go back from 1975. Go back 16 years, so if you go back 15 to 80, 1979.
So 33 to 59.
Yeah, or 19, no, he died in 75.
Yeah. So it'd be, so he, for about a quarter century then, roughly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you saw him in that office. You got some, did you ever work in, help him yourself?
No.
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 But what was involved in heading the grain trimmers at the Lakehead? And this was in all the elevators, I presume. There was no distinction in
no, they, Port Arthur, they did
Fort William,
all the loading.
That. Yeah.
They did all the loading.
Yeah.
He had to look after the bookkeeping, but he had to assign trimmers where the job opportunities were. Now, the trimmer's office was in the Chapel's building, and the Lakehead Grain Exchange was office was just around the corner from the trimmer's office,
right.
So that there was close connection. And first thing every morning, they would tell my father, or whoever was in charge, where the ships were going to be loading
right.
that day. They'd probably do it in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and he would have crews assigned,
yeah.
and they would be on the job at 8 o'clock in the morning, or 7 o'clock if that warranted it.
See, in a sense, one could compare it, I guess, to the hiring hall function that some unions have maintained for a long time. He was really in charge of assigning the
yeah.
men that, as you were just saying.
Yeah. And, now, first thing in the spring, and then through the fall, they would be a lot busier,
yeah.
so they would hire extra people. They wouldn't bring them into the union.
Mm-hmm.
But
did they call it a union, actually, or was it an association?
They had a separate title for it, I think.
Yeah.
But it was all one thing.
Well, it was, of course, but it
and they would have
masqueraded as an association, I guess,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. Well, the contracts were Lakehead Grain Shippers Association or whatever, Grain Trimmers
yeah.
Association.
Yeah.
And the other activities were the Lakehead Grain Trimmers Union.
Sure.
Local number so-and-so of the stevedores.
Oh, they did? They belonged to the stevedores?
I think it was the stevedores, yeah.
It must have been, or it still is, I guess, an interesting amalgam of the two.
Yeah.
With whom were the contracts signed?
With the boat companies.
So with the various
yeah, I walked
companies.
In one day, and Dad was on the telephone. There was nobody else in the office. He was on the telephone. And he motioned me to be quiet and sit down. So I sat down at the end of his desk and I listened to this conversation, and he was being really hard-headed. And it became apparent that he was negotiating a raise for loading ships of a certain company.
Yes.
And it went on for about a half an hour. And at the end of the half hour, he said, okay, we have an agreement. Would you put that in writing, Mr. So-and-so? And I'd forgotten the name. And we will abide by it. It will start at the first of this coming month.
Yeah.
Yep, okay. Put the phone down. I said, who's that? That's the CEO of the Canada Steamship Line. My father had a grade 8 education. And now that's Paul Martin's predecessor.
Yes, yes, you know, indeed.
Talked to him on an even basis, no
yeah.
question. And he got the raise that they wanted.
Yeah.
So much, 1,000 bushels, I've forgotten
yeah.
what the exact figure, but they loaded.
You don't remember roughly when this would have been.
Well, I think maybe he expressed it as 35 cents a 100 bushels.
Yeah, no, but I mean, when exactly in time this happened?
No,
you,
no, it's sometime after 1934.
Yeah, oh, I see. So, it,
yeah.
okay. Before you went off to war and so on.
Oh, yeah, when you were several teens. Years before the war.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but, carry on.
Well,
How many people were there in the office? Did he run
it by himself? There were two. When things got really busy, there was somebody else come in to assign crews and phone them because mm-hmm. they had all the communication was by phone.
Sure.
And
I guess the Great Dreamers would have to have telephones at their homes yep, so they could be yep, reached and yep, so on.
Yep.
You commented earlier on the sort of the quality of labor, if you will, or the kind of work that this was in terms of the incomes that men earned and
yeah.
the position they had in the community, I suppose, as a result.
At some point back in the dirty 30s, they were making $4,000 a year, and they were making it in 9 months. And that was a lot of money.
Yes, yes, it certainly would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I started at Harry Black's as a student in account at $50 a month.
600.
The banks were hiring tellers at $50 a month.
Hmm. 600, 720.
When I came back out of the army, I went back to Black's, and he gave me $100 a month.
1,200.
But then my wife got pregnant. And in those days, when soon as she started to show, she was out of a job.
Yeah.
And her job was, she was in charge of the payroll department at Northern Wood Preservers. Well, we can't live on $100 a month.
No.
You could live on $150. Harry Black offered me a $10 raise. Mm. I left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So $150 would have given you, let me see, 6 times 3, 18. 1,800 a year then, or yeah. towards 2,000.
Yeah.
And this is 10 years after, at least after the period you were mentioning when the Trimmers were
sure.
earning 4,000 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good money.
Oh, yeah.
What did they tend to do during the winter time?
The enjoy? Trimmers?
Yes.
Oh. Dad ran a bush operation in the winter. Now, while we were living in Stanley, and I don't know how big the operation was, but he had an agreement with Great Lakes Paper, which is Bullwater now.
Yes.
And he would have a crew or two cutting pulp along the banks of the Cam River towards Kakabeka. And you could start at the edge of the houses at Stanley, and there was maybe 200 yards between the railway tracks and the river, and go up to the bridge and then cross the bridge and beyond.
And his crews were cleaning this out year by year, working
yeah,
at it.
Yeah, yeah. And they would stack the stuff on the ice, and they had a way of marking to the end of the log so that Great Lakes would know whose it was.
Right.
And That's how he put in his winters. And even after we moved into town, he got together with George Squire and one of the other ones. I might have been one of the Chisholmores. Squire had some property on Hilldale Road. And there were a couple vacant sections beside Squire's. And they got permission there, and they cut the timber on that and sold it to yeah. probably to Great Lakes.
So he kept his connection with the forest operations even while
for
he
a
was
while, yes.
running the...
Yeah, yeah, for a while, yeah.
So he could, of course, have spent with the winter in Florida.
Not after he got into the office.
No, then was it a year-round position for him?
It was a year-round yeah. position. Although he got paid the same as the other trimmers. And he got it in so many months. Now, before he went into the office in the winter time, a couple winters, he dug sewers trenches down on Hodder Avenue, pick and shovel. That
easy work in the winter.
Tough.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
until they got rid of Moran, and then they were suddenly surprised their wages doubled, at least.
He'd been in, no, did he have, was he was investing for himself.
Yeah.
He didn't plan to
repay them. They didn't invest any money, they paid it all out.
Yeah.
Paid the bills, and then they split the rest.
Yes. Was the manager of the association, the union, paying the men as well then? They had a contract with the shipping lines. The shipping lines would simply lump sum them for whatever the cost for doing a
ship
would
bill. They would put the elevator would tell them how many bushels they had loaded on a ship, and they would bill the shipping. The grain trimmers would bill the shipping company at the agreed rate.
And then the office would know
checks would come in. Yeah, and
they would know how many men had done the job and how long they'd been there and so on.
Well, the trimmers as a whole split.
Right.
Whether they worked or not.
Your father would have been in charge of that paperwork as well, paying them?
Yeah.
This is the...
Yep. After he took over.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
So he had a certain amount of numerical facility, I suppose, numeracy, which his son, of course, inherited, as
for
I happen to
for
know.
For a grade 8 education, he had a very, very active mind. Now, he read voraciously. Mm-hmm. He read every National Geographic magazine that came out from, and lots of other reading.
Sure.
Yeah, he read all the time.
Well, the National Geographic is a great way of educating oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Has been. Mm-hmm. I've got the National Geographic from the beginning now on DVDs. They sold it for about $100. You can get it back to the 1880s, I think. It's very interesting to look through some of those issues or scan them on the monitor.
Yeah.
And you can print them off, too, PFDs. It's a really lovely job. So he was enjoying that. Let me see. What more can you tell us about the work that he did? Memorable stories. Now you were away from home. You were at war for how many years?
5 years.
42.
41. 40, no. 41 to 40, 45. December 45. April 41 to December 45. I couldn't get in to start with because my eyes weren't good enough. I had to wear glasses. And as I told the MO, what the heck does that matter if I get a bullet in the eye? It doesn't matter whether I got glasses or not. I'm dead.
Yeah.
But, and then they lowered the requirements and I got in.
Yeah. Which unit were you in?
I was in the 49th Field Battery, which was a unit recruited in Kenora and Dryden.
Mm-hmm.
When I passed medical... I had to attend the armory, and what do you want to go? Where do you want to go? They have openings in the 32nd Battery, which was recruited in Port Arthur. And I said no. I was in the 4th Field Ambulance Militia for about 3 years. I got up to company sergeant major.
38 to 41 or something like that.
Yeah. And I said, no, well, the LSR is getting ready to go to Europe. No, no, thank you. I don't want the infantry. And they suggested the service corps. And I said, no, artillery reinforcements. Okay. You'll be on the train the day after tomorrow for Winnipeg. You'll go to the 10th District Depot up there.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, I spent Easter Sunday up on the Water Street Depot. actually, I spent Easter Sunday with the Freemans, Lois Wilson's parents.
Oh, yes.
He had been the minister here.
Right, he had been indeed.
Yeah, and I chummed with her oldest brother.
Mm-hmm.
During high school years, and on Easter Sunday, I was invited out to their place along the Assiniboine River.
Right.
Forgotten the name of the street.
So he was professor of theology. Was he already dean at that point at the United College?
Yeah. And
so you served and came back in at the end of 45. I was thinking in terms of your, did you hear anything of what your father was doing during the war?
He was doing the
grain. The grain continued to move, of course, yes.
He got special gasoline allowance because he had to deliver paychecks. And, there was tremendous grain shipments. In the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s, in spite of the size of the ships, they were shipping over 400 million bushels of wheat alone through this port. It was the largest grain shipping port in North America, probably in the world. Plus barley, flax, rye, screenings, you name it.
Yes.
They don't even come close now.
No, it's...
100 million now.
It's fallen off very badly from what it used to be.
Well, a lot of it's going west.
Indeed.
The federal government got meddling in it. I think, I don't know which way it went, but it had something to do with the shipping across the mountains, whether the Federals gave them an extra allowance or whether they took something away from the allowance here. I'm not quite sure what it was. Yeah. But Prince Rupert got a lot of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the market shifted.
I think the shifts to the Pacific certainly were China rather than Russia, I suppose. Yeah. And so, of course, that was beginning to happen around 1960 with Alvin Hamilton's endeavor selling wheat to the Chinese. Yeah. Well, the Russians continued to buy for some period of time, but the market certainly did shift.
Yeah, they found out that the commune system didn't work.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of history on the other side for sure. Did you have any sense of what your father was doing during the 14 years or so after the war, when you were back and getting into offices, bookkeeping and so on yourself? And
he bugged me. Get me a job with Hewitson's. And about a year after he retired from grain trimming, I got him a job as a flagman. We were repaving Lakeshore Drive from Otter Avenue to, from Bear Point to McKenzie. There was no highway then.
No.
That was the highway.
That was Trans-Canada Highway you were...
Well, it wasn't Trans-Canada then. It only went as far as Scriber.
Okay, well, this is in the 1960. Well, it was being built.
Yeah. And... one of my last instructions to him was, and you be careful of the equipment because they won't watch for you. Make darn sure you're out of their way. So he did the job, and it was getting near to the end. And the super on the job was a fellow by the name of Jerry Williams. He lived right on River Street, right opposite the end of Peter, right across from where Peter comes in. And Jerry was a little hard, but he was a smallish guy and full of energy. Well, he had to go off the job for some reason. And one of the 12-ton rollers was a brand new machine. And the guy that ran it took every opportunity he could to have a little rest. Well, Jerry had to go off the job, and the guy pulled over, parked the roller here. And Dad was flagging just a little bit behind him, 10 feet maybe, maybe less. And all of a sudden, Jerry appeared coming around a corner in his car. And he drove fast, and this guy hit the starter on the thing, and it was in reverse, and he broke Dad's leg. Mm-hmm. It's lucky he didn't do worse.
Could have crushed him to death.
So he was off for the winter, and he chomped around the house. They were living in the basement of our house on Eakin Street. And in the spring, he bugging me again. So I said, I'm not going to put you flagging.
That could kill you.
And I forget, it would be probably at the beginning of July. We were starting to lay pavement on the city contracts that we had. And red light comes on. We're going to need a flag or a scale man down by the asphalt plant, which is was at Hewitson's Quarry, where Glacier Ridge is there. There was a quarry in there. You came in off Winnipeg Avenue off the long road. Yeah. And that's where the shops were.
Sure.
And we had the asphalt plant there and we had a scale. So I gave him a little education in how to operate the scale and what tricks to watch for. And I said, you watch the trucks. If they've got chains and spare tires on when they come to weigh in the morning, make sure they stay on all day, you know.
Yeah.
And if somebody loses his turn, ask him what the problem was. And if he tells you he had to change a tire, what he probably did was took the tire off and emptied the water out of the tube and then put air in the tube. Well, they would fill all wheels with water, all the tires. And then they'd go and take it at a filling station, empty the water out, put the air back in, and they got paid for that water every load.
Mm. This was the first weighing in the morning was what counted.
Yeah.
After that was
well, for the rest of the day, that particular truck had that weight on his waist slip. And watch the driver. Don't let them get out of the cab. They'll weigh in with them in the cab, or with them out of the cab, and then they'll weigh every load with them in the cab. Oh, okay. Well, he was sharp, and he got to. So he did that for several years. I've forgotten how many.
Yeah.
But he was developing glaucoma, or cataracts. Mm-hmm. And in those days, cataract operation was a lot more serious, and they didn't have the skills or the internal lenses. So they would take the cataracts off, and then they gave you Coke bottles, the bottoms
of glasses.
Yeah. And he got those. But he was coming up to the point where he was going to have the operation. And it was late into the fall. It was in October sometime. And my mother called up to me and said, it's 6:30, and Dad isn't home yet. And I knew they'd been running in crushed gravel to get things started in the spring. I figured he might have been late, so I told her, I said, he may have to work, may be working a little later tonight. I said, wait till 7 o'clock, and if he isn't home at 7, I'll go down and see what's wrong. There was no phone I could get him at. So 7 o'clock, he wasn't home, so I take off in my car. Now, we lived on the corner of Egan and Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. My driveway was off Egan Street.
Mm-hmm.
His driveway was off Chamberlain and into the garage. And the back door was in between. So I go down Shuny on Algoma. And as I crossed Wolseley, I saw his car, come around the corner by the clinic, where the clinic is. Now, River Street didn't go through then.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw him come around that corner. So I pulled over. There were no curbs. I pulled over, and he passed, and I did a U-turn, and I followed him. He goes up McIntyre onto Shunia, and he no sooner turns on Shunia than there's a car coming towards him. He's right over to the curb, passed, then he's right over almost to the curb on the other side. And it's dark at this point.
Yeah.
And he passed a couple cars, and then there's another car, and he's over again. And I realized that he couldn't see into the headlights.
Yeah.
So we get home. He pulls into his driveway. The door goes up, he puts the car in, goes in. I go around the corner, which takes me a little longer. Go in, went in, went downstairs instead of up. And I said to him, "Dad, do you know how bad your driving is?" "What do you mean?" I said, "When you were driving over on the right-hand curb, you wouldn't have seen a parked car. Yeah. You would have plowed right into it." Yeah. And I said, "Once those oncoming cars passed you," and I said, "you couldn't see into their headlights, I'm sure." "No, I couldn't." I said, "you were right over to the left edge. And if there'd been a second car, you'd have plowed."
Yeah.
"It was that bad?" "Yes." For a minute. "Dear, my wife, you'll have to drive from now on." Yeah. "And you never drove again?"
Yeah.
"Just like that."
Just like so that person.
She had to drive him to work for about a week and then go pick him up every night. And she wasn't much of a better driver than he was.
Time to retire again.
They had a big Dodge Royal and they went down to Florida. She went through some small town somewhere in northern Florida or in the next state up, and the police pulled her over. She was doing 85 miles an hour. She used to give me heck for driving too fast. And then one of their trips, they took Bruce and Marilyn, my two oldest then, around Lake Superior. And I said, I told them when they left, "When you leave Sault Ste. Marie, you can get home here easily in an hour, or 8 hours, eight or so." I said, "Give us a call from Nipigon and we'll have supper ready for you." So we get a call from Nipigon. It's 5 o'clock. "We're just filling the tank now. I'm going to get a coffee and we'll be in right after that." Okay. So I figure they'll be in quarter after six, half past six.
The quarters.
Right on the dot of 6 o'clock, they pulled into the driveway and she was doing all the driving. So you figure it out. And the highway then wasn't like it is now.
No, that's for sure.
She eventually cracked it up in London. She pulled out of a parking lot onto a street and didn't see a car coming. She quit.
But survived the accident.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She cracked, broke a lot of ribs, but they had to fly her back.
Do you remember much about what your father was doing after the war and those last 14 years of his, almost half of his employment as the head of the Green Trimmers?
Well, he was still doing all the office work, right up until the time he retired. From 1934... until he retired, he was in the office.
Is there anything distinctive about that you remember, or was it pretty well the routines were well-developed earlier? Who, did he himself head the association?
No.
So there were...
the president of the union.
Yeah, of the stevedores local.
Local.
Yeah, so he was the business manager.
That's right.
For them then, or business agent, I guess it... Well, it's common enough in unions, isn't it?
The elevators union probably supported them because these guys, they knew their job.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was any twitches in the loading, the elevator people knew that they would be told, if something happened.
Yes.
You can never tell what's going to happen in that situation. No. I was down there one day when I was about 13 or 14, somewhere around there. I was still too young to get a job myself in the summer holidays.
Yes.
And they were loading, I think it was a cargo of oats, and the hold was almost full. And a cat came down the spout. It hit the grain in the hold and wow, and took off and went down the bob anchor rope onto the top. It took a gray streak
What a way to get out of a ship. As stevedores, I suppose they could have had a relationship with the men on the ship as well, the merchant seamen, I suppose.
Could very well be, although...
Obviously, the merchant seamen would be standing around, I suppose, while the trimmers were at work.
All they needed from the merchant seamen was to get the holds opened and closed.
Yes.
When the ship needed to be moved, well, they would tell the mate, whichever mate was in charge of the deck at that time.
Yes.
We're ready for number four hold, and he would winch the boat forward or back, whichever was necessary. Mm-hmm. They had the most trouble with the ocean-going ships that managed to get through. The smaller ocean-going freighters could come up to the Lakehead before the Seaway. There were some locks on the St. Lawrence.
Yeah.
But the ocean-going ships, they weren't nearly as efficient as the Lakers.
I
watched the ocean-going ships come in, and the trimmers always made fun out of them. It would take an ocean-going ship anywhere from a half to a full hour to dock in one of those elevator slips.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Lakers would come along. They'd have a couple guys on the dock with the bosun chairs, cables around two of the what they called nigger heads, the anchors on it, and they'd snub the thing down there. The ocean-going guys would come in and they'd get to the end of the slip. They'd want a tug to bring them in, and they'd have to be in right position and up against the dock before they put anyone ashore to put the cables on. You know? And it was a slow, tedious job. But that's the way these ocean guys did it on the ocean ports. I saw it when we came back from Kiska. Took them 3/4 of an hour to get tied up into a wide slip in Vancouver Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Whereas these the Lakers had been doing it time after time.
Yeah, they were knew everything. They'd come in there
and
chips... Well, even the big ones now, they do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's not a lot of need for tugs in Thunder Bay.
Well, it depends.
There
are certain areas where you couldn't turn a big ship.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the tugs to help them around.
Yeah. Did you get any sense from your father of... Were there changes taking place during these years? The Seaway was completed in, was it 57?
It was later than that, because I was working at New Idea Sheet Metal when it was completed.
Is that 59? So the retirement then coincides roughly, I guess, with the completion of the Seaway.
Somewhere around
the official opening.
Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth and President Eisenhower, wasn't it?
Well, he was 88 when he died, and he was 72 when he retired.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's put it in 59.
Yeah.
Well, any other insights into your father's career? He would have worked with a number of different presidents of the Association of the Local over the years, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. But that... The president didn't interfere with the office at all.
Presiding. Were they on strike at any time during those years? Or?
Not that I know of.
No. So when the grain was moving, they were working. And
while he was in the office, I heard no comments of any sort from him, even when he was talking to my mother, about having difficulty getting a contract with a shipping company. The shipping companies knew these guys. They knew their capability, and they weren't greedy.
No.
They weren't greedy.
Well, they were essential to a really efficient trade, efficient use of the ships, filling them up as much as they could and so on.
Yeah.
I wonder if the grain trimming is a trade that exists in other ports as well. One would think it would, but how it got started.
The Thunder Bay port, and I'll call it that. It was Port Arthur and Fort William, yeah. But the Port Arthur and Fort Lakehead William elevators,
ports. Yes,
and grain trimmers could load ships about 25% faster than they could load them in Duluth.
Mm-hmm.
They were that much better. Not only the grain trimmers, elevators themselves were that much better than the American elevators.
I wonder if Duluth and Wisconsin and Superior will have had grain trimmers as well working.
Yep. Yeah, they would, but there was no association.
No connection at all.
No.
Even though the stevedores local is probably continent-wide. Longshoremen International Association of Longshoremen.
I would say they belong to that.
Yeah.
But I have no knowledge of that.
I mean, in another industry, lumber and saw was a completely distinctive organization within the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners and did its own thing in more ways than one. Well, any other thoughts about it's a remarkable career. He wasn't thought of as someone from Quebec, I suppose, through all of these years.
No.
Your parents become members at St. Paul's?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, Dad was on the session for years.
So he was an elder?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He became an elder. He brought baptism was a little different then than mm-hmm. it was last Sunday. But what is now the minister's office used to be the robing room, minister's mm-hmm. robing room. And when there was a manse, the manse had a study for the minister.
Immediately behind the church in the
Yeah,
in
and
those
the
days.
New manse had, but two.
Sure, yes, of course.
So the people with the babies to be baptized would assemble in the robing room.
Mm-hmm.
And at the appropriate time, and it was during the first verse of a certain hymn, I've forgotten the hymn, but Dad would lead them in, go over and take the top off the baptismal font and stand aside. And when the baptisms were over, he would cover the font and then lead them out.
How long did he do this for?
Oh, he did
years?
That for years.
I see. Yeah.
I don't know when he went on the session, but he was on the session probably at the beginning of Mercer's tenure anyways.
So that's early, mid-40s, soon after the war.
Yeah. At least then, if not sooner.
And did Mr. Mercer leave about 61 or so, I guess, was it actually? I'm trying to remember.
Was
Hugh MacDonald his immediate successor?
Yes.
So that makes it about 62, give or take.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting. Do you want to add, I might ask you, Owen, is any aspect of this business?
I was just thinking of how they got paid. The money they would bill the shipping company, and then the check would come in. So the boys would have to wait until that check came in before they got paid. Or did they have a bank account?
Well, they had a bank account.
Yeah.
The checks would come in, and the checks would go into the bank, and there would be a stream of checks. Now, they had a record of how much they had loaded and how much money they would get. I don't know that they had any borrowing arrangements made with the banks, but they probably had a pretty fair idea of how much they would make in a season, and then they would apportion the money out accordingly.
Because, of course, the contract monies would have to include your father's salary, even though he wasn't actually moving any grain, redirecting a single kernel of grain.
Yeah, but he got the same pay as the fellows that were working on the boat.
And one more question of extreme importance. Did you ever have a chance to keep your dad's wooden shovel? Because I understand each grain trimmer had their own tools.
There is a possibility that it may be out on Highway 61 at the museum out there.
Oh, okay.
It Pioneer? May be.
The Founders Museum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may be out there.
What are the other things?
They didn't own the plows, or they owned them, but they left a plow at each elevator. There was a plow at each elevator.
For each of them in?
No, no. They only needed one plow.
Okay.
Because you only, if yeah. a hold was coming up to being complete.
Yes.
You could only have one man working right. in it anyways.
I suppose they took turns then doing that.
Yeah.
Actually.
Oh, yeah.
Spelled each
and
other
some
off,
of them were better at it than others.
Sure.
And they knew if Dad was, if it was at pool one, Dad would say to so-and-so, get ready with the plow. I'm sure that he would say, get ready with the plow, and the guy would go over and grab the plow mm-hmm. and prevent anybody else, because there were certain ones that were fairly clumsy, yeah. Yeah. and it would prevent them. There wouldn't be any fuss about it.
Right. You know?
I think the reason I asked, I think we were talking to the McKinnons, they had their, they were quite proud of their family shovel, and it was hand-carved, I think, by their grandfather, so...
Oh, they were handmade, these yes. shovels.
Yeah.
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 They got them somewhere locally. They got them made locally. Mm-hmm. It was a smallish shovel, but it was all wood, mm-hmm. one piece.
Yeah, they wanted sparking, I think. That was one of the reasons why it was wood when they were working
yeah.
on the metal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't want a single
spark. And they
spark.
Were light.
Yes.
Because they used it to spread the grain, yes. you know.
As you mentioned, they had this tool, but you also mentioned... A second tool, or was there
the
just
plow.
This one?
Plow.
The plow.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned the shovel, that, or
well,
was there a shovel?
The wooden shovel, yeah. Well, but each trimmer had his own shovel.
Right. Quite aside from this, the plow that was
yeah,
the...
Yeah, there was the only main, one plow
right.
As an elevator.
To go with the
because
with the chute.
They very seldom were loading more than one hold at mm-hmm. a time, although they could,
yeah.
because the spouts were stacked along the front of the elevator, but... Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of that was dictated by where the grain was stored in the elevator. Because when the grain came in, it was not cleaned. It had to be, there might have been a rough cleaning on the prairies.
Sure.
But it had to be cleaned in the elevator.
Yeah.
And that's where it was the initial cleaning. And then it would go into those storage tanks.
Right.
Now, if there was a big shipment coming in, it would go into the storage tanks, then be cleaned and sent back into mm-hmm. them.
Yes.
But it came out of the storage tanks at the bottom, went along a belt, into a hopper, and then there was an endless belt of buckets.
In the elevator.
That took it up the thing and dumped it into the weigh scales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And from the weigh scales, it went into a hopper. Mm-hmm. At the top end of the spoke.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other aspects of it?
That exhausted my questions.
So one of the interesting things that gradually has come to light in some of the interviews is the consumption of alcohol at the workplace.
I was never aware of it, so I can't. I can't comment.
Right. Well, that's
I
fine
wouldn't
too.
Be surprised. But,
you weren't a great trimmer.
No.
Or
no.
a great handler, or whatever.
No.
Or various other things. Well, thanks very much, Larry, for
taking
us into the life of your father and quite a remarkable man. We have the portrait here. I don't know whether it's worth carrying a. An image away after we shut the machine down, perhaps. But it's a lovely picture to think that he served as an elder for some years, or whatever length of time it was at St. Paul's.
Was
I mean, that's...
you didn't get that from St. Paul's.
Oh, the records, of course, yes, yeah. No question about it. Well, thanks again very much, and I'll have Owen shut this down in a moment, and...